let me start my exciting Radio Shack stopwatch to get a time. Hello there, I'm Phil Parr. Welcome to Blind Like Me. It's good to have you with us. Our guests today are Roger and Marilyn Smith from, can't remember where you folks live. Slipped my mind.
Louisville.
I get the magazine every week, and I remember Keats. That's all I could remember was the name of the street. I thought and thought all day. Now, where the hell do these people live? Louisville, Kentucky, home of course, the American Printing House for the Blind. They've had, I think, a couple of the organizations have had conventions there in the last 3 or 4 years.
It's a very popular convention site.
Marilyn, correct me. Did you live in San Antonio when we were kids?
Yes,
when
you? I did.
I was thinking you did. I was just trying to kind of remember back. Marilyn and I went to school together. I don't know if and you were in the group with Tommy Tollison, Gene Ellis, that group.
No, I was 1 year ahead of them.
1 year ahead of them.
Yeah, my class was Eddie Blue, Jerry Burns, Margie Russell, Emily Van Pelt.
I remember all these people. I remember Eddie Blue was a wonderful. He's a big Hank Snow fan. He used to sit around here on Saturday afternoons doing Hank Snow runs and playing. I was so envious. I wanted to do that so bad, and I just didn't. I didn't think I could. I later learned how, but at that time I didn't think I could. So Marilyn and I went to the Texas School for the Blind together back in the 40s during the W. E. Allen regime during the during some very difficult days, and we won't get into that. But anyway, Roger, what is your schooling?
I went to the Kentucky School for the Blind. I'm the Kentucky connection. I grew up down in southern Kentucky and went to the School for the Blind here in Louisville, actually.
And so you lived in Louisville. Were you a day student?
No. I actually did the whole dorm bit.
Yeah.
I did the residential bit.
Yeah, but your folks live there in Louisville.
No, they live down in the sticks in southern Kentucky, about 130 miles away.
Okay, so back then, 130 miles was a long...
Well, it was, because back then you didn't have the interstate systems that you have now.
Oh, no. It was a much
different deal.
Plus the fact that in Texas, we think, you know, Lubbock to Dallas, that's just a trip. But here, a 300-mile trip would, I mean, they would just freak out.
Yeah.
You know, it's all relevant to the size of the state. Yeah.
We went up and did a little kind of New England sort of tour, and it was just amazing how quickly you go across those little Pennsylvania and Massachusetts, those little states up there, whereas, you know, you drive in Texas.
But to people who live in these states, they think a 130-mile trip is a long trip. It's all relative.
We lived in San Antonio, which was 80 miles from Austin, and back then it took... It seems like about Miss Ellis's old car took about 4 hours to make that trip.
It was a whole different animal.
Oh, man, it was. Both of you are totally blind?
Yeah. I had some partial vision until I was 13. I lost the rest of it. One of the house parents, in her infinite wisdom, sent me upstairs to be in trouble for something. And when I came downstairs to the meal, I hit my eye on a chair. And there went the rest of my vision, so I was not able to see colors. And all I could see was colors and very large letters on boxes of products like Tide or Kleenex.
But you were hurrying downstairs to go to supper or something.
Yeah.
And bumped your eye, and away it went.
Yep.
Did you realize the significance of what had happened then? Did it dawn on you that
Well, it was right at Christmas. It was in December.
Yeah.
And so I knew that I really missed. Christmas was never quite the same for me after that, because what I loved was seeing the colored lights against the green tree.
And you could no longer do that.
You know, it didn't really interfere with my travel that much, because we were so geared to getting around that campus that... The only difference I noticed that way was that I had to be a little more careful. I could count open doorways before when I was going down to a classroom. Couldn't do that anymore. I had to go more by the echo from the stairwells and things like that.
But we all walked around that campus with no canes, nothing. And we weren't taught any mobility. That's the thing that still amazes me, is that no one showed us how to use a cane. You'd think that would be something they would start a blind kid 6 or 8 years old.
Well, it was just coming in, though. The veterans who came back from World War II got it at Heinz,
yeah,
and it grew from there.
I guess that's true. Roger, I guess you all walk around your campus without assistance.
Absolutely. In fact, that's what I was going to say. I went to school quite a bit later, and we still were not taught to use the cane on campus. Nor do I think we should have been. It wasn't necessary.
Wasn't.
But we walked around just openly without a cane or anything campus. Always did.
Just how much younger than us are you?
I don't know if Marilyn will let me tell you or not.
Yeah.
I don't know how old you are, Phil. I'm 53.
So I'm 66.
I'm quite a bit younger.
I'm 66 and feel every minute of it every day.
So I'm just a spring chicken compared with you.
You're just a child compared to me. I guess Kentucky was like Texas, a dormitory situation. We had three or four cottages of boys and three or four cottages of girls, and they were.
When I first went to school, I was in what would have been considered the little kids' cottage, the little boys' cottage, and both the little boys and girls' cottages had the old just open dorm, one great big room concept, and which I always hated. And then as an older student, went into the big boys'. And they also had a big girls' cottage, and there you got into the rooms with three to a room, and each room had a bath. Each two rooms shared a bath.
Oh, really?
But yeah, it was very, very much the same.
Yeah, well, in Texas we had bathrooms down the hall. I mean, we had rooms, but the bathroom was a big bathroom. Maybe there were two of them. Were there? I can't remember if there were two, and there were several showers, but I think there was just one big bathroom. But And Maryland had the same thing. In K, we had the big dorm. She had Miss Bratton, and I had Miss Young. You could put them in a basket, and you couldn't tell the difference when they fell out. They were both just damn mean old women, is what they were.
We had a few like that, too, believe me.
That's all they were just mean old women. They didn't really care about the blind kid. Just put you down for rest hour on Saturday and Sunday and get you out of my hair. They really cared about it. But they wouldn't put up with that these days, and
they wouldn't. It's amazing how that's all changed.
Now, I know Maryland did quite well. How did you do academically in school, Roger?
I was a good academic student. Always was. I did very well. I did not go to school until I was 10 years old.
Really? Why was that?
And I just kind of sitting around home, doing nothing, blind child didn't have to go to school type syndrome. And I have an older brother and sister who are also blind. And my brother got out. He decided that he wanted to leave home and got out and came to Louisville to work at the Industries for the Blind when he was, 25?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that kind of spurred me on. I think that and a few other things spurred me on. And I realized that I did want to go to school. But I made my own decision to go to school when I was 10.
Looking back on it, we got a lot of kids like that at Texas. Kids that had no schooling whatsoever and came in. They put them in what we call the opportunity room, and they let them teach them Braille and teach them some skills and try to catch them up.
Yeah, I had been fortunate with the other blind kids in the family who were considerably older than I was. I had been fortunate enough to learn some Braille at home, so of course that helped. And I did go into the first grade, and of course that was quite late at the age of 10.
Yeah, it was.
But I got to skip some grades later and kind of get caught up. But no, I was always a good academic student.
And Marilyn, you did quite well as a Braille reader and as an academically at the Texas school.
Oh yeah, I didn't have any trouble.
And regardless of what we think of the Texas School for the Blind, educationally, academically, they did well.
The biggest gap was science. We didn't get enough science in high school.
Wonder why that was. Wonder if they figured blind children wouldn't need that, or they couldn't do it, or wonder what their thinking was. Or
I don't know.
And the biggest gap in Kentucky definitely was geography.
Well, we got plenty of geography.
I know you did.
Because I loved
it. Not at all.
That was one of my favorites.
Mine too.
Miss Wynn, you had her, I think, in the fifth grade. She got me into geography, and I loved geography. I would memorize, if you want them states and capitals, I'm your man. I got them down. She made sure that you learned things like that. Again, we had, of course, F.E. Lewis for science, and I guess that probably wasn't his master. He probably didn't. They needed a science teacher, and he said, "Oh well, I can do that." So, let's see, Marilyn, you graduated, you did 12 years, 12 grades in 12 years at the Texas school. And then after school, what did you think at 17, 18 years old when you were ready to walk across the stage, get your diploma? What did you think you could do with your life as a blind person?
I wanted to be a teacher. I knew that. And I didn't know exactly where I wanted to go to school. But that was, my parents were teachers, and most of my aunts and uncles were teachers. I just plain came from a teaching family.
So you wanted to be a grade school, high school teacher, public school teacher?
I was a teacher of history and government.
Did that come to fruition? Were you able to do that or not?
I was able to get through the 4 years of school, but I was not able to get a job. And I had to fight like a wildcat to get my teacher certification because the college that I went to, which was Southwest Texas in San Marcos, and that's where my parents had gone to school. They went to school with Lyndon Johnson, by the way.
Oh, yeah?
But, yeah. And I got through at the beginning of my senior year to go up to apply to do my student teaching, and they told me they weren't going to let me do it there in San Marcos. Because the president of the college told me he had to think about the children of the state of Texas. Well, I thought,
what does that mean?
You might imagine.
What does that mean? Had to think about the. What do you mean by that, reckon?
He felt like he was putting them in incapable hands. And he thought his responsibility was to make sure that the teacher product that came out of his college was the best that those students could get and that I wasn't. Because, you know, I was blind.
But I'm sure you made good. Your GPA was good.
Oh, sure. Oh, that wasn't the issue. It was a blindness issue.
Well, that's another thing today. They couldn't get by with that today.
Not very easily.
That would come under great scrutiny by news media, or if it didn't, you could make it, and you could make enough noise.
I had a sorority sister who lived in Rockdale, and she said, I know that Mr. Mormon will let you do it in Rockdale. And I said, oh, sure, Peggy. But sure enough, he did. And so I went up there and got my student teaching.
So there was
teacher certification.
There was a college in Rockdale. There was a college in Rockdale, and they let you do your student teaching there?
No, it was a high school.
Okay.
You didn't actually. I'd done all my academic work.
Okay.
All I lacked was the student teaching. You had to be in a public high school to do that.
And this guy at Rockdale let you do it?
Yep.
Bless his heart.
Yes.
Really? But then you got the degree and you still couldn't find a job.
No, I interviewed down near Houston in several towns and took phone calls and, did all the applications and all that. And it was always the blindness issue. Had I chosen to go elementary or something, I think I would have had the same issues because of the problems of teaching writing, handwriting. But by choosing high school, they were scared to death of the discipline problems and that sort of thing. And so that's when I decided to go with the Peace Corps.
That was going to be my next question. Didn't you eventually go get some sort of certification in a foreign language?
No, I had 3 years in high school and 3 years in college. I already had...
You knew Spanish.
My Spanish under my belt. And so when I applied, I knew they'd send me to a Latin American country.
Uh-huh. And you applied to the Peace Corps, and they accepted you. I'm sure they talked to you about the blindness issue because it would be an issue.
Well, what they wanted me for was to teach and help build a program in a school for the blind. So they liked the blindness issue.
Okay. All right. Somebody likes me being blind. That's
good. I thought that was cool.
Oh, I love it. And where did they end up sending you?
To the Dominican Republic, which is down close to Cuba.
Now, you got on a plane and flew to the Dominican Republic not knowing what you were getting into. How much did you know about the situation that was on the ground there?
Well, they trained us first. We had to go through 4 months of 3.5 months of training first. So we went up to Vermont and spent 2 months upgrading our Spanish, getting all the shots that we would need for down there, learning about the culture and that sort of thing. The rest of the people in my group were going to be doing economic development. And So I had to sit through their lectures. But they did send me to Perkins and a couple of other schools to sort of get the lay of the land, what it was like at a blind school, as if I didn't know.
Yeah.
Then we went to Puerto Rico after Christmas. They sent us home for Christmas for a couple of weeks. Then we went to Puerto Rico, and we went to an Outward Bound camp where they kind of tested our courage, and they sent us on these excursions. Well, they taught us to do survival swimming, and they did some rock climbing, some jungle camping, and that sort of thing. And then finally, they let us go to the Dominican Republic.
But were you the only blind person with a group? Or?
There was a partially sighted girl with me, Maggie Holt. She was at that time.
I know Maggie.
Yeah.
I know. I know.
And she did not make it through the training. Her personality just did not fit with their guidelines.
Is that right?
So she was not allowed to go. She went through all the training, but she was not allowed to go to the Dominican Republic.
So there's a chance that in this training you can bomb out.
I think 4 out of 32.
Well, I figured if they got you that far that they were going to take you regardless of... But not true.
They did extensive psychological studies, and they did thorough background checks. We all had to pass security clearance.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a pretty gutsy thing. How old were you? You were 21, 22 then?
22, I guess.
That's pretty gutsy for a 22-year-old. I don't know that I would have had the nerve to have done that. And you went to the Dominican Republic. How long did you stay?
I was there about a year and a half.
And, you were with the group that you trained with also went to the Dominican Republic,
yes,
right?
They went. They were scattered over the island. I saw them when they'd come into the capital city for supplies or for medical treatments or whatever. The capital city was Santo Domingo. But they were scattered throughout the islands. We were the fifth group into that country.
Uh-huh.
There had been others go in before us, nurses, well diggers, teachers of English,
And, of course, there were some people from the Peace Corps already down there.
That's what I'm saying. We were the fifth Peace Corps group into that country.
Help you get established. And you taught blind children Braille?
I didn't teach them Braille. I basically organized the program. All they had when I came in was somebody who came in a couple hours a week and taught a culture lecture, whatever that was.
Yeah, what is that?
And a girl from Canada, a woman from Canada who had, she was a Dominican, but she had gone to Canada to learn Braille. So she came back and taught Braille. But they sent me to the foundation, American Foundation, with some money to buy some supplies because they didn't even know what to buy. They had no multiple copies of textbooks. You wouldn't believe it. I taught geography and math and a little English and a lot of recreation and daily living.
Just get daily living skills for blind kids.
Just trying to get them to believe in themselves just a little bit and to know that they had the right to an education.
Yeah. Did you live in a group of home? You lived in a what sort of situation?
It was a big old house. The downstairs, the men were housed, and there was an office, a classroom, two classrooms actually, and the dining facility and a chapel. And then upstairs there was my room, which had three patios off of my room, and one of those became my classroom. I taught outside.
Okay.
And then there was the room where the women were housed and a couple of guest rooms.
So did you looking back on it, was it, did you enjoy it?
Oh, yes. I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was a different experience, you know.
Oh, I'm saying it was. What a thing. A gutsy thing even for that time, because we're talking about back in the 60s.
Yeah, 60. We arrived in the DR in 63, so we were down there when Kennedy was assassinated, and we came back in 64.
All right. Well, what a good experience. What a gutsy thing to do, and I'm sure you've never regretted a minute of it.
Oh no.
Roger, tell us your high school. You graduated high school. What did you think you might want to do?
Well, actually, I'll go back just a little bit further than that.
All right.
I actually left high school in 72.
Yeah.
And Marilyn and I got married. I had met her
really
through my brother and his wife. And I moved to Austin. I left school and moved to Austin. I immediately did my GED. I was not, my intention was not to be a high school dropout.
Yeah, so you went and got a GED.
I immediately studied for and passed the GED test because I knew I might want to go to college later.
Sure.
And, but I didn't start out that way. When I left KSB, I was very well trained as a piano tuner technician. And I started out, actually very shortly after that, we moved to Lubbock, and I got my first job in Lubbock Music Center for a big piano store.
Why would you move to Lubbock, for God's sake?
To get a job. Well, Marilyn had gone to Tech and had done her master's degree at Tech, and she liked Lubbock. She knew it was a friendly place. And as a matter of fact, as I remember, I had a choice at the time. I had a choice, and I might offend some people here. That's not my intention, okay?
It's all right. Go ahead.
I had a choice at the time. She came home from work one day. She was working in Austin at the time. She came home, and I said, "Well, babe, I've got a choice of jobs in Houston or Lubbock. Which one are we interested in?" Because I didn't know Texas at all, or very little. And she said, "Oh, definitely Lubbock. It's a very friendly town. It's a much smaller town. Let's go Lubbock." So we did.
Well, it would be easier for a blind person to get around in.
Lubbock is a dream to get around in.
There'd be no question about that.
You know, Lubbock is the way its streets are laid out. We enjoyed our time in Lubbock. We were there for 11 years.
Well, by then, Houston had become a megalopolis.
Right.
Because I moved in 72 for that reason, because it was so big.
Yeah.
And, if you had a playing job and you lived in South Houston, to get to North Houston to play, it took an hour.
And I think Houston might be one of these cities that if you grew up there and if you live there, perhaps you could develop some loyalty to it. But coming into it, not knowing anything about it, I think we just thought it wasn't what we wanted to do.
And you went to Tech some, Maryland.
I did my master's at Tech after the Peace Corps.
And so you were pretty familiar with Lubbock. So Lubbock, Texas, you went, and Roger, you were gonna tune pianos the rest of your life.
I was gonna tune pianos the rest of my life. And I did the job, the music store for a while. Had my own piano tuning business. Marilyn and I even ran for a while, owned and ran a retail piano store where we Yeah, we repaired. Yeah, this was in Lubbock. We got a lot of old upright pianos from peddlers. The piano peddlers would call, they'd get them out of old farmhouses and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they would bring them in. We'd buy them for a little nothing, and I'd fix up the actions. And we had an employer or two, and we did that for, a couple of years, I guess.
At least.
And, maybe a little longer than that. I also trained at some point in there or after that to be a vending stand operator. I took the training in Austin. And
they just didn't offer us anything good.
No. At that point, by that time, I'm not going to say that it was impossible, but it was getting more and more difficult for a totally blind person to get a large stand. You could get the little, the marginal stands, the dry stands.
But you needed some sight to handle the big ones.
Exactly.
And so the big ones
that didn't work out. And
the big ones are where the money is.
I guess it must have been, late 1978 or 79, when I just finally decided, hey, I want to be in a more human-oriented field, and besides, I'd like to make some money. That would be nice. And I'm gonna do the college thing and, see what happens. So I was at the ripe old age of 24, almost 25, I started my bachelor's degree at Texas Tech. And that's one thing that I wanted to talk about, because after you talked with Marilyn, because all of my degrees are in education. I have a bachelor's degree in education. I have a VH certification, and my master's degree is in education, concentrating in voc ed. And how things had changed by the 70s, I had absolutely no problem at all doing my student teaching.
Really?
No, none whatsoever. It was just assumed that I would. It had really, really opened up a great deal by then.
You know, I did, before I talked to you all, I did a couple who live in St. Louis, are 25 years old, and both a little bit discouraged because they're both radio nuts, and they can't find anything in communications, and she's applied for two or three jobs, and so is he, and they're a little, if you want, but there's no way to tell them of the turns and twists that one's life is, or the one will go through before they reach the point we're at where we are now. There's no way to explain it to them.
I think that a lot the mistake that a lot of blind people make, and maybe not just blind people, but I think it really runs rampant in blind people, if you will. How many blind people have you known and do you know that want to be in radio?
Hundreds.
And if you stop and look, it's always been difficult to get in radio, but if you stop and look at the situation now, you know, when you stop and think about it, Phil, how much commercial radio employment is even available out there for anyone?
With all the satellites.
Yeah.
I don't know how I've thought about that. I don't know how a blind person, you know, I got in radio because I went to a little dumpy radio station and bought 2 hours a week, and I was better than anybody they had, so they ended up hiring me.
Yeah.
But you can't do that anymore.
No, you can't.
And
no,
it isn't
you can't
anymore.
Because most of the community stations are doing automated stuff.
Well, sure, everybody's fed by the satellite. The disc jockeys in Minneapolis or Los Angeles or some other place. But that's not going to change. Blind people are going to fall in love with their medium, and that is sound. I mean, they're going to, you know, that's not going to change.
And no, it is.
I feel so, you know, I didn't know what I was going to, how I was going to, I knew I was going to do it, but I didn't know how I was going to. And I was lucky and persistent. Boy, was I persistent.
You had to be.
Anyway, so, Roger, you went back to school at 24 and got not one but 2 degrees?
I did. I did my bachelor's degree, and right after my bachelor's degree, or actually during the last part of it, Marilyn and I got certified together to teach visually impaired children.
Okay.
That was graduate work, but it didn't have anything to do with my master's degree. And by that time, our children, we have 2 children, and they were getting to the point that although we were still satisfied with Lubbock, and after I finished my bachelor's degree, I got a job in Lubbock that I liked very much. I was teaching severely retarded children it was a private school, a self-contained school in Lubbock. It was operated by the public school system, but it was a self-contained school.
But it was very satisfying.
And, by the time I was ready to do the master's degree, our children were getting to the point that we were kind of wanting to get them some experience at a school for the blind. And I suppose we considered Austin. I really don't remember whether we did or not.
It was just so far away.
Well, now, these children of yours, are they blind? Do they have eye issues?
Oh, yeah. They're both totally blind.
Both totally blind?
Yeah.
What a deal.
And so we decided on Louisville. We decided to move back to Louisville, and that the kids would go to the school for the blind here, and I would pursue a master's degree at the University of Louisville and do substitute teaching at the school for the blind, and that's what we did.
And that's exactly what you did.
Yeah.
Well, I'll be darned, Marilyn. What were you doing all this time? Were you working?
I wasn't working. I was going to have a family, and it didn't happen. And so we decided to adopt. This was about 5 years after, you know, we'd gotten married. We finally said, okay, it's time to give up and adopt. And we adopted our daughter from Korea in 77. And, of course, as soon as we got the papers saying when she was going to arrive, I found out I was pregnant. So we got 2 children within 5 months' time.
So you adopted a blind child?
Yeah.
Yes.
And then you had a blind child?
And then I had a blind child, yeah.
So you had 2 kids, 2 new members to your family within 5 months?
Yes,
our family grew rapidly.
What a thing. And this all happened in Lubbock.
Yeah. That's right, yeah.
But then it was the piano tuning. We were tired of that. You wanted to, like you said, you wanted to make some money.
I wanted to make some money,
an old boy, you could tune pianos a long time, and a lot of folks do well at it, and it's a great way to make, for a blind person to make a living, but there ain't no money.
It worked for us. There were times when our piano tuning business did very, very well. And that would be great, and you would think, wow, this is really great. It's coming on. The problem with it is then there are times when it doesn't do anything at all.
See, I wouldn't understand that. You'd think it would be consistent. You'd think word of mouth would carry you, you know, you'd to different churches and different places to
tune. And what you get into a lot there is in large churches and schools and that sort of thing, you get into the contract thing.
Yeah.
And you can contract, and I had some contracts to tune, you know, so many pianos a month and that sort of thing. But if you do that, then you can't charge. If you have one of those contracts, then you can't charge what's normal for a piano tuning. They expect a big discount.
I've been there. I did those. When I got out of school, I was Mr. McKinley taught me to tune and repair. So I went to our church, and, of course, they couldn't turn me down because we were good members, Park Memorial. And I tuned the first couple of Sunday school room pianos. I pulled them up to pitch, and I finally said, to hell with it. These folks will sing a step flat.
Really?
It's okay with me if they sing, you know. Because you pulling the piano up to pitch is a, you know, you got to do it and then do it again and then do it a third time.
You can't do it in one tuning at all.
You can't do it in one tuning.
And you could break a string.
And you really can't even do it in one day. I mean, even if you do it in two... If you tune the thing two or three times in the same day, it's probably going to come right back down.
Well, I think I was charging these folks $10 a piano.
It was 15 by the time I was doing it. And that was for an in-home tuning. And for the contract, you could be down to 10, maybe even as low as 750.
These folks probably had 50 pianos, and I spent the summer tuned them all.
Exactly.
Tuned a little while, go smoke a cigarette.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, let's take a little short break here and then come back and talk with Roger and Marilyn Smith from Louisville, Kentucky. I'm Phil Parr. Show is called Blind Like Me. We'll be right back in just a minute. Thank you.
Research team certifies screen reader friendly. Now, with this week's Blind Sight, here's Tim Cummings.
Let's say you want to send somebody a large file. Now, most email programs have a problem that you can't send a file over a certain amount to somebody. Well, you should try www.sendspace.com. That's sendspace.com. This is a great site. You can upload a file to somebody, and what you do is you just type in the file name and upload it, and you type in the person's email address of the file that you're going to send them, and then you type in your email address if you want a copy of the link as well, and you hit send. And what this does is it uploads the file to a website and sends that person an email with a link in it where they can go and grab that file and download it to their own computer. It's a great site. It's very accessible. I'd give it a screen reader friendliness rating of a 9. And the nice thing about it, too, is it's got a little counter, so it'll actually tell you how long it'll take to upload the file. Now, obviously, if you're running a cable connection or a DSL connection, it'll upload faster than if you're sending it via modem. But that's www.sendspace.com. I'd give it a screen reader friendliness rating of a 10. And for Blind Sights, this is Tim Cummings saying, keep on blind sighting.
If you found a screen reader friendly website you'd like us to mention, send your email to blindlikeme, all one word, at txucom.net. And join us again next time for Blind Sight.
Back to Blind Like Me. Roger and Marilyn Smith from Louisville, Kentucky are our guests. Both of them college graduates. Both of them had some jobs they liked, some jobs they didn't like. Roger spent a good bit of time tuning pianos. Marilyn went to the Peace Corps, went to the Dominican Republic. But both of you ended up in Louisville. This would be, we're into the 80s now, I guess, aren't we? We're into early 1980s.
I did my master's in Louisville. And got the kids some of the experience that we wanted in the School for the Blind. And then at that point, my goal at that point was to actually teach at the School for the Blind. And, of course, I had subbed when I was doing my master's. But it became apparent as I was finishing up my master's degree, School for the Blind was beginning to kind of fall apart at that time. It was still academically inclined. It was still... it was still pretty good, but you could see the signs of
of them go, and I, when I say fall apart, I mean as an old-fashioned school for the blind.
Well, it was becoming a school not for for children, but because just blind kids went to public school by then.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And they were going to public school. The big push was for public school, for mainstreaming. And it just became very apparent that I was not going to get the job that I wanted there when I wanted it. If we'd stayed here long enough, I probably would have.
What did you want to teach at the school for the blind?
I really didn't care. I would have taught, you know, I would have taught most anything. What I really wanted was to teach piano tuning. And just about the time that came along and the old piano tuning instructor who had been there for 100 years retired, they decided to close up the piano tuning department.
You know, I talked with someone at the Texas school, and you remember, and I'm sure Louis, the Kentucky school was the same, that all the time during the day from the afternoon on when you were out of school, there was this cacophony of sounds coming from the main building. There were two or three guys tuning pianos. There were several people playing pianos. Yep. There was Jack Weston playing the trumpet. There were drums, and there was just this gigantic noise coming from the main building. That is no longer there. They no longer do that.
No, they don't. And I really hated to see them give up the piano tuning department, because you're not going to find a person who is any more into technology and modern ways than I am.
Yeah.
However, to this day, I would maintain that if they had students there who were capable of learning piano tuning, I would never say that it's a good way to make a living. But I would maintain to this day that it is a wonderful way to get a little side income. Now, that's getting less and less true with all of the digital pianos that are on the market. There are less and less acoustical pianos. Still, it's a way, and I hated to see them give it up, especially in the 80s.
Our guy here in town, who is Glenn Nairn, you may remember him. He's older than we are, Marilyn. He said he's got more work than he knows what to do with. The college just keeps, in Nacogdoches, just keeps raising his fee to keep him because there's nobody that can tune pianos anymore.
Exactly. No, there's a shortage. And so, it's going to get worse before it gets better.
It's just funny that they gave that up for blind schools.
Yeah, I think it was really a tragic mistake. But all of the states were doing it, and Kentucky decided to follow that.
Oh, yeah.
So I got out and chased around after jobs for a while and found a teaching job teaching mostly some elementary kids, teaching them just, you know, blind type things, Braille and all kinds of skills in London, Kentucky, which was up in southeastern Kentucky, just about 50 or 60 miles past Lexington. And we moved to London. And
Deep Appalachia.
Yeah, Deep Appalachia. It's a different world up there.
I bet it is.
The first time I went to a restaurant, I had a driver assistant. Because we were teaching all over the county, in fact, in a couple of other counties. And the first time I went to a restaurant there in London, which was like the first day I worked, I guess, we got in there and got settled in, and the waitress said, "Okay, have Ewan's made up your mind yet?" And I'm going, "Oh, my God, what have I done?
Have Ewan's made up your mind yet?
Have Ewan's made up your mind?"
That's what my grandmother said, Ewan's.
Yeah,
I've never
exactly.
heard it. Wasn't in Texas. But you, I'm sure that in Appalachia there was a need, a tremendous need for people, skilled people to teach
absolutely.
Blind kids.
Absolutely, there was. Absolutely. Probably still is.
Well, it would have to be.
And I taught there for a year, and then by that point, Marilyn's parents were getting in bad health, and we moved back to Texas. And I taught in Texas for some time, just so that we could be closer to them and you know, give them the help that we needed. And then we moved back to Louisville for good in 89. I retired. We both retired and moved back to Louisville for good in 89.
So. Decided that you liked Louisville better than you did Texas.
We always knew we really wanted to come back here because we wanted our kids to finish school up here. We liked the situation better.
It's too hot in Texas.
But we needed to take care of my parents, and they both passed away in 88. And so we came back up here.
Well, it is hot in Texas. Now, I guess your kids went to the Texas school for a little period of time.
My son only went to summer school there. My daughter went for a year to the Texas school.
Yeah, it's you wouldn't. I guess it's been probably longer for you than it has for me. You wouldn't know it anymore. It's completely a completely different thing. Of course, there shouldn't be. They'd be 150 years old if they were there when we were there teaching, but there's just, you know, it's just totally different. Yeah. Anyway, so you're back in Louisville, Kentucky, and both of you decided at that point in time to retire.
Right. Yeah, in theory. We have taken on some other projects, but
yeah.
In theory.
Oh, yeah, we want to talk about other. Both of you have magazines, and so but in theory, you retired and decided to live the good life and enjoy yourselves for a while and quit chasing jobs and those kind of things. You had the degrees. What's the point? Now, we want to talk about the snakes, but before that, let's just do. Both of you have music magazines now.
Roger,
Roger, you've had yours for a good while, and Marilyn, you just took one over. Is
I
that right?
I just took one over, yeah.
All right. Well, tell us about this one that you're doing.
Okay, mine is Rockin' Round the Track, and it's called that because it came originally from the track Tape Recording and Conversation Club, which is kind of like the old Voice Spotters Club.
Yeah.
And it was one of their magazines, and the woman who was running it, her equipment started going bad on her, and I said, I'll take it over if you want me to, and so she did that this spring,
yeah.
And I got the first issue out the 1st of July, and the second one out October, and I'll either do a Christmas or a first of the year issue. It comes out approximately quarterly, and it's rock from, it could be anything from the 50s up to now, probably concentrating mostly in 60s through 80s,
and this is of course you already had a tape duplicator because Roger was doing his, so it was just a matter of putting it together and duplicating it.
Right. Usually I do one side and then I have a guest do the second side. Usually it's somebody else who receives the magazine and they offer to do a guest side for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that works out real nice.
Do we want? Are you interested in more people getting? This is free,
sure.
I guess.
It's free, yeah.
All right. Well, let's do Rogers and do you get them at the same address?
Yeah, the address
yeah.
is the same.
All right, Rogers I get yours, Roger, and it is just plain country, folks.
It is just plain cornbread country.
I love
mine
it.
Mine is called the Listener's Choice Magazine, and that's because we do give people the option of sending in requests if they like, and we try to come up with them, and sometimes we can, sometimes we can't, obviously, but it's country music. I always tell people from the 30s and 40s to the current time, mostly what it is, I would say it would be fair to say 50s through the early 80s, maybe. Is that fair?
Pretty good.
I would think so, but then I've heard you play some modern tunes.
Exactly. You'll hear a modern one thrown in, and then you'll hear one back from the... You'll hear an old Blue Sky Boys tune every once in a
yeah.
while. But I master that on the computer and then dump it onto a cassette, and as you were talking about with Marilyn, duplicate it and send it. I'm sending it out to, 100 people,
mm-hmm.
now, I guess.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, I receive it and listen every month. And if you don't, if you're a country music fan, you would enjoy it. And I'm sure if you're a rock fan, you'd enjoy Maryland. What is the address for receiving receiving these magazines?
Yeah, if they want to write to us or drop us a tape or something like that, they can just send it to our address at 115. That's 115 North Keats Avenue, Keats Avenue. And that's in Louisville, Kentucky, and the zip is 40206.
Now, what if you want to start receiving the magazine? Same address?
All they have to do is to get us their name and address. That's really all we need. And tell us that we would like to be, that they would like to be put on the list to receive it. It's free. One thing I should specify is that we do not do foreign mail. This is U.S. only. We started out doing a little overseas mail, and we've just had so much trouble with tapes that didn't get there, losing tapes, that sort of thing. But it just wasn't practical for us for a free service.
You do these free matter.
We do.
Yeah, well,
the typical library.
Oh, which is the way you ought to do them. That's what that's for.
Right.
This is material for blind people to enjoy, and that's the purpose of that. And Maryland's same address.
Mm-hmm.
If you were there, you could get both, what the deal is you get the tape and then you send it back, and it's re-recorded on until as long as it's a good tape. I'm sure you check those before they come back. And
it's also available still online if anyone chooses to do. Well, the listener's choice is right now, and Rocky Around the Track's about to be.
Will be soon.
www.bluegrasspals.com. And from there, when they go to that website, that's our website, and then they can just click the listener's choice magazine and find all of the issues.
And
there.
You can listen to every issue there. You can spend the day listening to good old country music.
Yeah. A whole lot more than you want, probably.
No, you can't get more than you want. All right, we're getting down on time, but we've got time to talk about your fascination with snakes.
You probably just ran 30 people off, right?
No. My wife said, snakes? What would a blind guy want with snakes? Well, why, you know, sighted people do it. What would be the difference? So anyway, how did you get interested in snakes? Tell us about that.
We went to an alligator show in Florida. We have taken various trips in our motorhome to various places in the southeast and also Texas, of course.
Yeah.
But we went down there to the beach in one of those Atlantic coast towns.
Yeah, St. Augustine.
St. Augustine, I guess, yeah.
Okay.
Went to an alligator farm, and they had a show with exotic animals, and they had a snake, and we petted it. Roger said, you know, I've always thought I'd like to have a snake. So that was the beginning of a long story that's lasted for 12 years.
Part of it may have been a little rebel feeling on my part. My mother was scared to death of snakes, and she has told me many, because I'd always had a little fascination with, I'd read a book about somebody who had a pet boa constrictor, and that had always fascinated me. And my mother used to always tell me, now, Roger Dale, you can do anything you want to, but you'll never have a snake. And bless her heart, I guess she's turning over in her grave now. But
so you thought you'd I'll show her.
You know that was subconscious. I really didn't think about
it
that much, but I think there was probably something to that.
Well, you saw this snake, you petted it, and you thought, this is neat. I'd like to have one. Where does one go to buy a snake?
We came home and did a lot of reading. There are several books in the library, and, of course, we were able to scan books and that sort of thing. And we did a lot of reading on snakes and their habits and the various, you know, breeds and species and that sort of thing. And then we just started looking at local pet stores.
We decided we wanted boa constrictors to start out with, and we bought two. And then we just started adding to the collection.
Now, boa constrictors are snakes that if they bite you, you're in trouble.
No,
not at all.
No.
We've never had a venomous snake at all.
That's not true. Most snakes aren't venomous.
Most of them are.
Most snakes are harmless.
I would never, ever condone people having venomous snakes. There are those who do. But to me, you know, a snake, like any other animal or any other person, a snake can have a bad day and bite you. It doesn't happen very often, but it can happen.
And
with
sure
our snakes,
has.
It doesn't matter. It's all superficial, and it doesn't matter if that. If you were into venomous snakes, it would be deadly.
What really the media focuses on all these sensational stories, and usually what happens is the person is dealing with a snake who has either been starved to death or mistreated. And the snake coils around them and gets them in such a situation. It's usually not a bite that kills or injures the person. The snake bite itself, it will bleed, but it goes away really fast. It's their ability to constrict that is scary, especially with a huge snake.
That's what I was going to say. That's not likely to happen with a boa constrictor that like we've raised. So that's more likely to happen with a large python. And we've had those, but we don't now.
To tell people, you couldn't convince 90% of the people that live in East Texas that boa constrictors are not poisonous. They would not believe you. They would say, that's wrong. They've got to be poisonous. I've been told all my life they were.
Yeah, we've run into a few people like that.
Yeah, I'm sure you have.
One of the things that I do with the snakes is to take them out and educate children. And I think you run into more of that in older people. I know what I find is that the children are very open to snakes because they don't, you know, their minds are still open. The parents who are usually quite young are open to snakes, but then when you get into the grandparents, you know, it's like, what are you doing to my grandkid? That's very true.
I've never. Just like, you know, it's like so many things that you miss if you're totally blind. You don't My wife finally taught me how the proper way to wave at people when they're leaving. I'd never seen anybody do that, so I didn't know how to do it. I've never seen a snake. I don't know. I kind of have an idea what they look like, but I don't know. Are they how big around is the, are these boa constrictors that you have? What size are they?
Well, they're like people. It's
different.
It just depends on the snake. Our biggest one right now is she's a boa, and she's about 7.5 feet long and weighs about 13 pounds. We just lost one that we had. In fact, it was one of the first ones that, well, one of the two first ones that we got. Livy was, she was also a boa constrictor. She was more in the 8 feet, 8.5 feet category, and weighed up close to 40 pounds, between 35 and 40 pounds.
Mm.
And then we have some snakes that are much smaller than that. We have snakes who are, you know, just normal size, you know, pencil-like snakes.
They feel more like duct tape than anything else, I think. They don't feel slimy unless you just pulled them out of the water.
Okay, the surface of them is like duct tape.
Yeah,
feels
yeah.
Kind of a little rough.
Yeah, yeah.
Sort of rough feeling, and their bodies aren't the same all the way down. I mean, they have a head, and they have a...
Sure, they have a head and a tail.
They're skinnier at the head and the tail and fatter in the middle.
Yeah. Hmm. The reason that we chose, one of the reasons that we chose boa constrictors to raise and breed is that most people don't realize, most snakes lay eggs, but boa constrictors are live birth. And
okay.
that held kind of a fascination for us, and it was just, you know, we love it every time it happens.
Okay, but first day, you bought a cage of some sort of a contraption to...
About a 30-gallon aquarium.
Oh, an aquarium. An aquarium that you think of aquariums as full of water. These aren't.
And these are not. These are dry for, you know,
reptiles.
We keep them dry so that reptiles. That did not last long, but go ahead.
And so you bought the aquarium and you bought a couple of snakes, or one snake, or.
Right.
Or
in, two, yeah.
And had either one of you, until you had this experience in St. Augustine, had either one of you ever seen a snake?
Touched it briefly,
yeah.
Maybe. Skin,
yeah.
Anyway.
Now, before we bought those two snakes, we bought one big one. We bought Livy, who was the big 40-pound snake, and then we bought a smaller one. And we went to the pet store several times before we bought her, and I got so accustomed to her that by the time we actually bought her, I was going in and opening up the door to the cage where she was and pulling her out and holding her. So I at least knew how to handle her, but before we brought her home, and that was just a thing that we were able to work out that, you know, you wouldn't always be able to. The pet store, I guess you want to sell a snake for one thing. But she was kind of fascinated with us, and she was just very, very good.
So you just use a silly word. You bonded with the snake before you bought her.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, we loved her, and she loved us.
How do you pet a snake? I mean, what is the? I'm sure they enjoy certain things more than others. So how do you do that?
We like to put them around our shoulders and just rub their scales. Unless you know a snake, and I know that sounds funny, but unless you have a relationship established with a snake, you pretty much leave their heads alone, because they can be a little what they call head shy. And, you know, that it's just like if you meet a strange dog, you take it easy until you know what that dog is going to do.
Uh-huh.
And it's the same thing with a snake, but we like to put them around our shoulders and maybe let them wrap around our arms if they're little.
And then, of course, we can pet, having the relationship with the snakes, we can pet our snakes' heads all the time.
Oh, yeah.
But we don't, if I'm educating a child with a snake, I always say don't pet their head. And another thing that I always do is to say, these are domesticated snakes. Don't go out in the wild and pick up a snake. You don't know what it is.
Well, really? And you both just made the decision that you were going to buy and bring home snakes. So you bought an aquarium, you brought this large snake home, and this is the one you just lost that weighed 40 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
Did this, was it male or female?
Oh, she's female. Female. She's one of our big breeds.
And did she weigh that when you bought her, or was she...
pretty much.
Yeah, she was pretty much your
grown
daughter.
Yeah.
And you mated her with a male snake? And
not the one that we bought that day. That was a baby snake. We decided we wanted a baby and a grown-up because we thought that our son would like the baby snake better and be less afraid of it and whatever.
Uh-huh.
It turned out it was okay. It didn't matter. But it was going to be too long before Charlie grew up, so we bought another big male snake to breed with Livy.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't always work out that well. We were just very fortunate. We, by that time, we had them in a big space built up over a bathtub with shelves and trees. I mean, you know, limbs.
We're talking like 7.5 feet tall up over the bathtub.
Yeah. So they had their own little habitat.
Really?
If you have them in a place like that, which most home breeders don't, they will come near breeding.
And but there was a chance they might not like each other.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, sure.
That is so, to me, so strange, and I'm sure to a lot of people. But to you, it seemed like a perfectly normal thing to do.
We've been doing snakes long enough now that it's just every day. I mean, it seems very normal to us.
The biggest snake that we have now, our big boa Snickers, has never bred. She just will not breed.
Never
and we don't know if she's infertile or if she just doesn't like guys or what it is.
When you can't, and there's just no way to ask her.
No.
Can't
she loves
exactly.
us. She's the best hugger we've ever had. She'll give you a great hug.
Can't exactly do that. And she is how big? She's
about 13 pounds. She's about seven feet long and weighs about 13 pounds.
She's long and skinny.
Well, I may have to come to Louisville and see your snakes. I've never touched a snake, and I guess I ought to do that. And I'm sure that we've got hundreds of blind people listening who never have.
Well, you know, it's really interesting, Phil, because, by the way, ask your friend John Bennett about John has seen snakes. He would tell you it's okay.
Did John come and visit you?
No, we visited Texas. We had snakes with us.
Oh, you did now. He did.
Now, Gail was nowhere to be seen.
Gail
and Joyce disappeared.
Gail had left. Did John hold the snake and touch the...
He definitely petted her. I don't remember if he held her or not.
I think last time John Bennett was at my house, he was seeing snakes after midnight. But that's another story. Listen, you alluded to the fact that you have, I guess you still have, a motorhome.
Yeah.
And you get someone to drive that for you.
We hire somebody.
You hire someone to drive. We have had three. We now have a, what do they call it, fifth-wheel camper.
Oh,
with
yeah.
With the thing that pops out on the side that makes the living room and
sure,
kitchen.
Right.
Three times as big.
Right.
But boy, motorhomes, there are so many things to go wrong in a motorhome. And you're always, I mean, you go on a trip and put it in the shop and go on a trip and put it in the shop. And
you know, with this, now we have a miniature motorhome now. We've had large ones. And
yeah.
Right now we have a mini home, which is like 24 feet. We use it like a car. We use it all the time. And it really has not been bad at all. The only problem is now with gasoline going up like it is.
Yeah.
We get, for those of you who don't know about the wonders of motorhomes, we average, what, about 7.5 pounds of the gallon?
Oh, at least.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That hurts.
I know. Listen.
But, you know, back on snakes for a minute, what I was going to say, as far as breeding snakes, you know, I have, and I would love to find out I'm wrong about what I'm about to say, because you were saying that a lot of people would hear this who probably, you know, would think, wow, I couldn't do this. Obviously, we've known a number of blind people with a snake, or a couple of snakes.
Yeah.
We have yet to run into to other blind people who have actually raised snakes, had multi-snakes. At one point, we had 50 adult snakes when we were just kind of experimenting, figuring out, you know, what we liked and what we didn't.
Mm-hmm.
We're down to seven now. It's a difference.